This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and today's visit with 93-year-old Richard Cruz of Bakersfield, California, originally from East Lansing, Michigan. The story goes he journeyed to California in 1948 to watch his unbeaten Michigan Wolverines destroy USC 49-0. He enjoyed the Southern California sunshine so much on that New Year's Day that he decided to transfer to UCLA, and he's lived in the Golden State ever since. For nearly two decades, he was a volunteer docent at the Palm Springs Air Museum, but in 1945, he was a navigator on B-24s modified for solo missions with the 55th Reconnaissance Squadron, tasked with trying to produce a more accurate picture of the Pacific's volatile weather. They had extra fuel tanks in place of bombs and a 10-man crew prepared for long days.
Enlisted men were flight engineer, crew chief. We had two radio operators because we were sending a radio message every 20 minutes. We had an armament officer who was also the ball gunner and then a tail gunner. Then the radio operators and flight engineer, they doubled as turret operators or machine gun operators. I had been trained before navigation school in the nose turret, and so that was my specialty. Had we ever been under attack, it was my job to man that nose turret and defend the airplane best I could from there.
Well, and that seems to be another distinction in flying these missions, because if you talk to most guys who flew on B-24s, they're flying in formation, so they have the protection of the rest of that formation, the rest of the squadron. Sometimes they had fighter escort in addition to that. But you guys flew your missions just all by your lonesome?
Yeah, they would be 14 to 16 hours, typically, sometimes a little longer. Out of Guam, we flew in a large triangle, basically south of the Marianas. We would end up paralleling the equator, because on the equator, there's something called the intertropical front, which exists at all times. Sometimes you don't see any cloud formation at all. Other times you'll see this buildup of clouds, and that's where the typhoons develop that do so much damage in the western Pacific. So as I say, we were monitoring that on a daily basis. So we typically flew every 3 or 4 days, but those missions were almost always the same.
Well, and there's a lot of questions that come to mind about the uniqueness of these missions. But what about the danger factor? Did you feel like you were doing dangerous work, and were there some occurrences that made that awfully clear to you?
We were sent into what they considered enemy territory, and our hours were considered combat hours. Our real danger was engine failure.
Because if that happens, who's going to get you?
Yeah, we're a long way from home. That was a concern a couple of times. But anyhow, I often thought that if we ever did ditch, and we went through, of course, I didn't know his name at that time, but Zambini, ditching and eventually washing up on an island. The worst thing that could happen, that you maybe could find an island, and would there be a Japanese element there? Because we flew with 45 sidearms and a shoulder holster. They had tracer rounds in them, so if we were ever on the water, we had some means to signal a plane that might be searching for us. So that was standard thing. You never got in the airplane without a 45 strapped on.
So you've got a few potential hazards. I mean, if you could face anti-aircraft fire from ships?
Yeah, that would have been a possibility, but very remote. We were told to stay at least 50 miles away from truck. That's still late in the war, could have been a problem. There was another island called Yap that had been bypassed. That was near Ulithi. We were also told to stay away from there, just on the chance. The intelligence on that was probably a little outdated, but just on the chance that they could put something in the air and come after you. If you see a lone airplane, it might be vulnerable.
They might even have fighters coming back from a mission elsewhere, and if you guys are in the area, you're sitting duck for them.
By that time, by late in May, June, the summer of 45, those Japanese locations were pretty much neutralized. They had very little potential, but trucks still did, but it had been bypassed and cut off pretty well.
But if you guys had been approached by a fighter, you're probably in pretty big trouble.
Yeah, we felt we were pretty good gunners too. You know, we hadn't had a lot of practice, but we'd had some firepower. So, you know, I don't know that at that time, our young age, we were invincible. I don't know that we ever worried all that much or even talked about it. You know, that came later when you reflected back on all of it. Could have been, you know.
Well, I'll ask you some more about those potential dangers too, but since you mentioned your crew and you're operating together, did you get to fly all those missions with the same group of guys?
Yes, yeah. All 10 of us started out in training. Again, we left the bombardier off. We had some other changes, guys that just didn't fit. We had one guy we liked a lot, but every time we went in the air, he got airsick. My pilot finally said, "It's breaking my heart, but I don't need this guy, you know, in a crisis, and he's going to be airsick regardless of, you know, what we do." So he was just a neat kid that we had to leave behind and took on somebody else.
And how well did you get to know that group of guys over all those hours together?
As a crew, we were probably closer to our enlisted men than the rest, because our enlisted men told us that they were kind of the envy of all the guys they lived with, that we paid more attention and really spent more time with them in various, you know, activities than the other crews. When we spent a little bit of time on Kauai, and, you know, we would in the evening go out and just walk the beach and enjoy being in Hawaii, because we were headed further up to something else, you know. Yeah. And same way on Guam, we had get-togethers, fish fries, and things we could do, but our enlisted men were always included, and that wasn't true with every crew for whatever reason. You know.
That is unique. I wonder if any of that has to do with how long your missions were, that you guys were stuck with each other in that plane for 18 hours.
We had plenty of time to get acquainted, even if it was over the intercom, you know. And we all kidded each other. As I said, the weatherman and myself, we claimed we were the only two guys awake most of the time, because we were the only people really working. You know, I still don't know what the guys in the back, the gunners and everything, I think they mostly were just laying around trying to be comfortable, you know.
So are you saying you never nodded off at all on any of those missions?
I didn't have time. There was no way. I had to be jotting down, and I had a routine I went through. I had Loran. That made it easy. But I spent a lot of time looking through a drift meter to be able to estimate what the winds on the surface were, because that was important for them to know. My navigation, I could determine what the winds at altitude were, and there was usually a difference of some kind, which was part of what they wanted to know. No, I didn't have much time to relax. The only time that I did was that our radar operator had been trained as a bombardier, but he also had some rudimentary navigation training. And he told me one time, he says, "Hey, you come back and enjoy this nice, quiet radar room, and I'll come up and do a leg of this mission for you." Well, we did that, and I had just gotten a cup of coffee and a sandwich when we got a message, and the message was, "Investigate typhoon," and they gave us the coordinates. So I had to get back up front and get busy with that. And that was the day I probably did the most perfect navigation I did through my whole career, because I put the location of that typhoon on the chart, and we flew right to it. And the reason he was able to leave the radar was it wasn't working that day. So we didn't have an opportunity as we approached this thing to see the intensity of it. So the only thing we were ever told as to how to deal with this is, if you're getting into that really tough weather, get down on the surface about 500 feet and get through it that way, which we did. And we're down doing what we were trained or told to do, and it was the ugliest ocean I've ever seen in my life. And suddenly this airplane got thrown up probably the better part of 2,000 feet in a matter of seconds. We got hit by a thermal that took us up, and we actually stalled out as near as we can figure out. And by the time the pilots had that under control, we were coming out of this thing. But in looking back at it, we found the typhoon. We flew right through the ring, probably the most violent part of it, and we were lucky to survive it. And I think about that frequently.
Well, I'm sure you're making a lot of other people think about it right now, but they didn't hear a lot of fear or anxiety or trepidation in your voice as you described it. I'm sure at 93, it's a little easier to do that than when you were 20 years old at the time. What does that feel like when you start to feel the perimeter of that typhoon?
You don't have time to think much about it at the time. You really become more frightened after the thing is all over with. And we were always debriefed after every mission. So in the telling of what we went through, each one on the crew was questioned so that everybody had their version of this thing. It was then that I began to realize we were very lucky to come through this thing. Because what the first thing I knew, my navigation table was about almost chest high, and I stood to do almost constantly. The first thing I realized is my chin was on that table and my knees were buckling, and I'm looking at an altimeter and an airspeed meter, and the altimeter is going up and the airspeed meter is going down. And it took me a little while to realize what was happening in that department. Well, by the time we got thrown up, I still remember, have some memory of the sound of those engines, because we stalled and then the thing dropped through. And by that time, the pilots had everything forward, the throttles. They got as much power out of those engines as they possibly could. We were then in a glide. We were regaining airspeed. We were getting out of it. And through that process, one of the, I think, guys back in the waist said they thought they saw light or sunshine, because this got very dark through this thing. And the ocean was the darkest, ugliest thing you can imagine, but almost total darkness. And I just remembered, but again, I remember that after the fact. So the fact that somebody saw some light out of the airplane tells us that we flew through the ring, and that we actually came close to seeing the eye of it.
Would you recommend that experience to anybody?
No. Today, those guys fly into those things on purpose. They usually go in at a high altitude, and they fly into the center, the ring, and fly around, take their data, and then fly out. Well, there's footage on that, and these are, you know, pretty substantial prop jet airplanes. But those things just, with the footage you see, everything in that airplane is shaking. The instruments, the radar things are shaking. They're bolted down, but they're still shaking. That whole airframe is shaking. No, I wouldn't want to do that today, ever.
Well, and you mentioned that somebody said they saw light, but I imagine a lot of people were thinking or saying a lot of things in that moment. Did you hear some chatter throughout the plane on your headset?
I don't think anybody had thought about being on that intercom at all. I don't remember any voice contact at all. The pilots, from their description, they operated in unison. They had flown together long enough that both were doing what they should have been doing in unison. One, you know, co-pilot wasn't doing one thing and pilot trying to do another. So that part worked just fine. Everybody else was just hanging on, you know.
And I'm sure it was over pretty quickly, but it probably felt like it lasted a while.
Yeah, I just, you were trying to, didn't realize what was really happening until you were really out of it, you know. And then again, I'm busy getting us back to Guam. So I didn't really sense a lot of this till we sat around a table and were questioned, and this occasion in greater detail than we had been on any other occasion. They wanted to know our experience, get as much information out of that as they possibly could.
And, you know, I don't want to belabor the point, but it sounds like you're saying you didn't have that moment of, hey, I might be about to die right now.
It was a very quick, if I had that, it was a very brief moment in my life, you know. I just honestly can't remember that part of it.
But how many times have you looked back on it since and said, boy, I easily could have had it end right there?
Oh, yeah. If a wing had dipped or something, we could easily have gone into a spin. And we were at low enough altitude, I don't think the best pilot in the world could have gotten us out of it. A spin with that amount of altitude and still a lot of turbulence, you know.
So you credit that to the skill of the pilot or what?
Yeah. I would have flown anywhere with Jim Worsham as a pilot of B-24. I just had that much confidence in him. From listening to them talk about it, they did everything right with that airplane.
And you said when you came out of the typhoon, you had to find your way to Guam. How'd you know where you were?
Well, I had the report. That typhoon was exactly where they told us it was. I knew a general direction, and then I could refine it as we went, because that Loran would give me a position within a minute, within a mile, mile and a half. And when we came back into Guam, I always tuned in. There was a Armed Forces radio station, so I was always listening to that and double-checking to make sure that needle was right on zero, that we were headed to Guam, because that station was probably in the center of Guam somewhere.
So it sounds like you're probably saying that was your closest call in your time over there?
Yeah, the other one was we were somewhere south of the Marianas, and we had a propeller run away. We couldn't control it, so we had to feather, and it was the number 3 engine. And because we had that extra fuel and guns and the radar, we started losing altitude. We typically flew at 8,000 feet, so right away we're starting to lose altitude. Well, my pilot declared an emergency and had a radio men send out a mayday. They picked us up, and we were told to fly to Ulithi, which was a Navy fleet anchorage. We were told always to stay away from there. They didn't want anybody flying into that airspace. There was no reason for us to be there. So we head for Ulithi, and I'm checking the position. I mean, I'm working as hard as I know how to work, and I'm watching that altimeter, and it's going down, and we're getting closer to Ulithi. By the time we got to around 3,500 feet, we pretty much stabilized. Thicker air, we burned off enough fuel. So about that time, we're talking about tossing guns out of the airplane, and are we better off to ditch, or should we bail out, or what should we do? And that's, you know, conversation taking place over the intercom. Well, about that time, we see 2 Navy fighter planes. They come out and get on our wing. We had a bubbled window in the nose. So my pilot called me up, and he said, get your Aryan face in that window so those guys can see that you've got round eyes. I did all of that, and then I think they wigwagged a little bit because we were waving at them. And the next thing we see is a PBY. We call them Dumbos, but they were out there as a rescue in case we went down. We had a rescue plane right on site.
Pretty tense times, but he's here talking about it, so we know he survived, and we'll find out how that attempted landing unfolded when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.